Welcome to the Compliance Perspectives Podcast. I'm Adam Turteltaub from the Society of Corporate Compliance and Ethics and Healthcare Compliance Association. Joining us today is Alan Usby. Alan recently retired as a Senior Vice President and Chief Ethics and Compliance Officer for HCA Healthcare. They are the largest U.S. healthcare provider. Alan, thanks for taking the time to talk to us.
Adam, it's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
So we're going to start today before your healthcare years, talk about the defense industry. And most critically, I'd like to talk a little bit about the Defense Industry Initiative, which was very ethics focused and in many ways set the roots for compliance and ethics programs. Can you tell us a bit about the what's popularly known as the DII?
Well, Adam, I'd be delighted to. You know, I had the good fortune during my career in 1986 to become the coordinator or executive director of what was called, as you pointed out, the Defense Industry Initiative on Business Ethics and Conduct. Often the acronym you mentioned, DII, was used. And the effort started in the mid-1980s and quickly grew to include about 50 of the largest defense contractors. To me, it is such an important milestone in the whole story about ethics and compliance because the effort of the defense industry to develop these ethics and compliance programs was really the first organized effort, I think, for organizations, many of which were very large, to try to decide what constitutes an ethics and compliance program. That under the DII agreement that was signed by these 50 or so defense contractors, the signatories agreed that each would develop a code of conduct. Each organization would have an ethics and compliance training program. Each organization would have some kind of hotline or ombudsman. In addition, we would have best practices forums, typically annually, but sometimes more often. And it was my pleasure as the coordinator of the DII to create these forums. They were usually day and a half long educational sessions and would have representatives for all of the members of the DII. And then the other fascinating aspect of this, Adam, was that we had a public accountability process. So each of the signatories would submit substantial information about its ethics and compliance program, and I would compile all that information into a report that was then publicly issued. So from the start of my work in 1986 through the conclusion of my work with the DII in 1997, each year we would generate this public accountability report, which provided a great deal of information about what these 50 signatory companies were doing, as well as some specific details on some of the programs. It was my pleasure to work with each and every one of the signatories to sort of counsel with them and advise them and promote this kind of conversation about what was happening. And it was my professional pleasure to sort of observe the progress that was being made. One of the other big evolutions in this time was increasingly the role of chief ethics and compliance officer in these companies was becoming a position that was placed at a higher level, often a position that reported to the chief executive officer. And so I think that the enhanced stature of the leader of the ethics and compliance effort, which was an evolutionary process between the mid-80s and the mid-90s when I was involved with this, was very interesting to observe. But I think, you know, we're sort of well past the start of the DII, and sometimes those not in the defense industry don't understand that a lot of the origins of what is being more universally done today really goes back to this DII effort now more than 30 years ago.
Yeah, it certainly was revolutionary at the time, and a lot of the things that we think of as just sort of normal, like codes of conduct, and as you mentioned, compliance training, owe a great deal of gratitude, I don't know if it's the right word, or respect to the work that was done in the early days by the DII member companies, and also the, you know, setting the precedent for sharing publicly what they're doing and sharing knowledge has had a long impact. Now, you spent how many years at HCA? I'm sorry, I don't remember.
21 years. I started with them in the fall of 1997 and concluded my service to HCA at the end of 2018. So a little more than 21 years.
Wow. So you certainly saw a lot of growth there. Maybe you could talk to us a little bit about the, key elements of the HCCA ethics, or sorry, the HCA ethics and compliance program, and maybe a bit about how it evolved.
Well, it was a big effort, obviously, from when I joined in the fall of 1997. Interestingly, I was able to use a lot of the work that I had observed in the defense industry and to adapt that. The compliance risks were clearly different compliance risks between healthcare and defense, but the processes could be largely adapted. So, when I always talk about our program, I talk about the fact that we had a large effort to set standards that involved our code of conduct and an elaborate set of policies and procedures. We had an enormous effort to create awareness of these standards through various kinds of education, training, and communications. We had an effort to surface problems and issues through an ethics line and through an internal compliance reporting system. And then finally, we have ways to sort of check and monitor our progress. It would take us probably an hour, I think, to do justice to talking about all the details of the ethics and compliance program at HCA. But I would say if you ask me about the very most distinctive aspects, there'd be three that I'd be inclined to mention today, Adam. One is we placed enormous emphasis on having effective local ethics and compliance officers. So in each of our hospitals and other organizations or facilities, we would have someone who is designated as the local ECO, ethics and compliance officer. We would have a guidebook. In the case of the hospitals, as I recall, the guidebook was about 35 pages long, which would explain in detail to that person how to effectively perform his or her role. We would have training. So for if you were a newly appointed ECO, and we have about 185 hospitals, so in one of our hospitals, you were brought to Nashville for a couple of days and went through an elaborate training program. And then we had division ethics and compliance officers who were full-time positions, and they would provide a lot of guidance to the people at our individual hospitals. So our emphasis on having capable, engaged local ethics and compliance officers who would make the program come alive in each of our locations was critically important. A second thing that I think was distinctive was that we had responsible executives in each area of compliance risk. Typically, the responsible executive was a corporate vice president who was considered to be the person with the most expertise in that particular area of compliance risk. And at the time of the conclusion of my service, as I recall, we had slightly more than 50 areas of compliance risk that had been identified, and about 45 of these responsible executives. You may say, why didn't it match up one for one? And the reason was, in some cases, we had responsible executives who handled two or, in one case, even three areas of compliance risk. But I think having these individuals, each of whom was tasked with developing a strategy for that area of compliance risk to include an identification of the main kinds of guidance and policy and procedures we needed, the main kind of training that was required, and what kind of monitoring might be available in that area. And then my job as the Chief Ethics and Compliance Officer was to meet with each of these people on a routine basis to explore the particular work plan in that area of compliance risk and to make sure we had an effective strategy both for understanding and addressing those risks. The third area that I think of distinction in the HCA Ethics Compliance Program was an energetic program of compliance process reviews. So we had a detailed mechanism for having a surveyor who would go out to a hospital, spend a couple of days there, but having gathered a lot of information in advance, and essentially go through a long checklist to try to determine if most of our core policies and procedures were being effectively adopted in that particular hospital. So this CPR team, as we called it, consisted of a leader and four surveyors, and the surveyors would go to hospitals on a several year rotation, and then they would write a report after the visit to the hospital in which they would summarize their observations and would give the hospital a score, and then the hospital would submit a corrective action plan as necessary. So I think amidst all the things we were doing at HCA, I think this local ethics and compliance officer emphasis, the creation of these responsible executives, and the development of this compliance process review effort occur to me as three of the most distinctive.
Well, and I think, starting with the last one, the CSR, the CPR teams, with so many organizations struggle with auditing and monitoring their program, it seems as if you have that well in hand. I wanted to go back for a moment to those responsible executives. How are they selected? I mean, obviously, you said they were selected for their expertise, but how were they identified, brought in, and then how long would someone typically serve in the responsible executive role?
Well, these were individuals who, of course, these were not new hires or new positions. They were individuals who were already functioning in some kind of leadership role at HCA. And then what I would do as the Chief Ethics and Compliance Officer is identify that person. Now, we did have a guidebook for the responsible executives, about 8 pages long, which told them what the job was. I had asked our CEO and COO to sign that guidebook so that the responsible executives would understand that they're being sort of brought into the ethics and compliance program was not just my creation or request, but it was being done with the endorsement and enthusiasm of the top leaders in the organization. But typically, what I would do is try to find that individual who was most engaged with a particular issue. Sometimes this was their full-time job. I mean, for example, in the case of Americans with Disabilities Act, which deals both with physical barriers and other related issues that are not related to physical barriers, we had people working on those issues on a full-time basis. So they were that person was the obvious responsible executive. Or in the case of clinical research, which we did a great deal of, we had a full-time person who was our assistant vice president for clinical research, and that person was obvious. So essentially, we looked amongst the talent at HCA to identify that person who seemed to have the most expertise and was therefore the logical person to take on this role.
So let me ask one more question as we're running out of time. When we're
Sure.
preparing for this podcast, you raise an interesting topic, which is microethics and macroethics. Can you explain to the listeners what you mean by that and how do you think about them both?
I'd be glad to, and I'll try to make it very brief, Adam, which is, basically, I think there is a major distinction in the types of ethics issues that are looked at by organizations. And I that by microethics, what I tend to mean are the decisions by individuals at points in time related to some ethical component of a decision that the individual is asked to make. And so, if someone, for example, let's say there were some issues about disclosure or integrity of negotiations in a contract negotiation or the like, I would call the way that the individual addresses these issues of transparency and candor and the like to be microethics kinds of issues. They relate to an individual business decision at an individual point in time. By macroethics, I have in mind more the business decisions of the organization as a whole, where that particular business decision has some kind of ethical import. So, a good example might be that if you have a multinational, a global organization doing perhaps manufacturing in many countries, and perhaps there is a country where you have a manufacturing facility that has less ambitious environmental standards than we might have in the United States. It would seem to me that an interesting macroethics kind of business decision would be, is it appropriate for that particular organization to meet the legal standards in each particular country where they operate, or should there be some consideration as to whether a more ambitious standard might be appropriate because they've shown some capacity to meet a more ambitious standard in other locations, and perhaps they think the more ambitious standard is actually more appropriate. So I would regard that as more of a macroethics kind of issue. I think that the important thing to try to accomplish with ethics and compliance programs is that the more particularly that the chief ethics and compliance officer and the program can focus not only on coaching individuals about how to resolve these microethics issues, but where that the function can also be a resource for the organization as a whole in identifying and speaking to these macroethics issues, that if you can do both those things, then you're really going down the path of having a comprehensive and maximally effective ethics and compliance program.
Well, Alan, thank you for, first of all, your many years of service to the compliance and ethics community. Thank you also for taking the time to talk to us today. I want to thank all of you for taking the time to listen. I'm Adam Turteltaub from SCCE and HCCA saying, I hope we're able to expand your compliance perspective.